from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. When Odeo first started as a podcasting company, it had so few customers that it offered to return its investors money. But it looked at what its customers wanted, changed its model, and became the company we know today as Twitter. Author Eric Ries says more startups should use that idea of continuous innovation. The author of The Lean Startup, Ries promotes applying the principles of lean manufacturing, where the focus is on the consumer's perspective. How can we apply these lean principles elsewhere? And if you're involved in a startup in Silicon Valley or considering launching one, we'd like to hear your opinion. Forum is next. Join us and join in after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Eric Ries joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, an entrepreneur and author of the blog Startup Lessons Learned. He has been involved in and advised a number of startups, as well as advising large companies and venture capital firms on both business and product strategy. Presently, he serves as entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School and is best known for his lean startup methodology, which has been written up in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Harvard Business Review. He lives in San Francisco, and he recently published The Lean Startup, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses. Eric Ries joins us for this present Forum Hour, coming full circle, in fact. I used to listen to Forum working down as an engineer in Menlo Park, and glad to have you. By the way,
thank you. It's my honor.
The book came out in 2011. I made it sound like maybe it was a little more recent than that, but it's gotten a lot of attention and a lot of people quite interested in what you have to say here. One of the things I should begin by saying is that you define a startup as an organization dedicated to creating something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty. Are those extreme uncertainties let's talk – I mean, you're a pioneer of lean startup movement. Are those uncertainties diminished by the lean methodology? And then we'll talk about it.
Well, that's certainly what we hope. When you talk to most entrepreneurs, they have a business plan. They think they know what they're going to do, and they're using a very conventional management technique, which is about as efficiently as possible doing the thing you said you were going to do. Of course, it presupposes you know who the customer will be, you know what the product should be, know what they'll want, know how much it should be, how much you should charge for it. And what I often liken that to is, in my experience, we're often building the wrong product. So it's like we're driving a car off a cliff, but we're doing it very efficiently. You know, it's on time, it's on budget, we're right over the cliff just when we said we were going to be. And so what we're trying to do with Lean Startup is bring some ideas from lean manufacturing in order to try to reduce that uncertainty over time and increase our odds of success.
Well, lean manufacturing is mostly associated with Japan.
That's right.
And it's a lot of focus is on the consumer, really. I mean, who's going to buy this product, which seems, I suppose, what any startup would have to think about, doesn't it?
You know, it's what we think about. The question, it's a difference between thinking about it and actually going out like a scientist and testing.
Empirically.
So, empirically. To find out, we think customers will want this product, but let's just double check and make sure. And when we start to make that our goal, we start to realize that a lot of the things that we traditionally do in product development, which seem like they're in the name of efficiency, are actually a form of waste. Because as I said, we're building the wrong thing with efficiency rather than efficiently figuring out, well, what is it that the customer wants in the first place? And so we want to take those ideas about rapid cycle time and reducing batch size and bringing the consumer closer to the development, you know, out of the factory floor and apply them to any startup situation, which, as you said, is any situation where we face high uncertainty about what is going to work. How do we build a new sustainable organization?
Well, you use a lot of fascinating examples. In fact, I guess the key word here that you use is pivot.
Yes.
That a company will start out and it'll have a certain vision and then it will realize that, well, what the needs of the consumers are may be quite different than what that vision had in mind. And so pivot. Odeo becomes Twitter.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because pivot's become quite the overused buzzword, and I get a bit of hate mail about it on a pretty regular basis. But it's a really important concept to entrepreneurship. A pivot is a change in strategy without a change in vision. So we're still dedicated to getting to the eventual destination we had in mind, but we make a realization based on what we learn in the market that we were slightly on the wrong track. And a lot of famous companies that people know now started out as something quite different. You mentioned Twitter. You know, Groupon is very much in the news now for its current challenges, but people often forget that Groupon began life as a community activism site called The Point, which was about, instead of collective deals, collective action, like to go petition City Hall. And when they made the pivot to do commerce, their very first Groupon was, if I remember this right, 2-for-1 pizza at the pizza restaurant in the lobby of their building. It's actually still in the lobby of their building. I've eaten there. The pizza's pretty good. And if I remember right, they sold 20 Groupons. So on day one of this new pivot, they sold 20 free pizzas. And you know, I know your listeners are much smarter than I, but I certainly, if I had been there at that time, I wouldn't have said 20 free pizzas. That means for sure they're on track to make $1 billion in revenue faster than any company in history. But because they had spent the time trying to get customers to use this previous service called The Point, they understood the power of 20 free pizzas because they realized actually it's quite hard to get 20 people to do pretty much anything at all. And so that gave them the impetus to keep iterating and changing and adapting in that new direction and, you know, ultimately turned out pretty well.
Well, we spoke about Facebook in the last hour, and Facebook started out as strictly college campus phenomenon. But also one of the more interesting stories that I guess I really didn't know much about was eBay, beginning with Pez dispensers.
Pez dispensers, yeah. You know, because people think about something like a Facebook or an eBay, we think about the biggest version of it we can imagine, you know, the kind we can tell our parents about and we're on the cover of magazines. Because in the movies, basically, it's a time lapse. You have your idea and then like there's like a photo montage, real short, no dialogue, and then boom, you're on the cover of magazines. So the movies skip over all this difficult stuff about figuring out, okay, how do we get from idea to something that really works, what we call product market fit?
But also, as you point out in your book, it's almost like making a film, all the people that are involved. And
that's right, get written right out of the story.
But talk again about how one goes about mining or finding the data that allows you to assume that you really have the best interests of you or your investors in mind when you're ready to pivot or you're at least on the verge of pivoting.
So the key is a concept we call the minimum viable product or MVP. It's another one of our buzzwords from the Lean Startup
Movement.
Most valuable
player.
That's right. That's right. It's been in the news for other reasons recently here in San Francisco. But the MVP is instead of trying to think about that big version of it, let's figure out what's the smallest thing we can do that still creates some value for our customers but allows us to start the process of learning as quickly as possible. So instead of building an online auction system for every kind of product in the whole world, let's just start with Pez dispensers.
Or,
and then maybe you buy Beanie Babies.
Or Zappos is a good example too. Yeah,
absolutely.
Which you use.
We use this in business schools all the time. We ask students to think about, all right, you're going to start Zappos. How would you do it? And they always think big. Well, we all know the customer service is important, so we have to build a big call center. Obviously, distribution deals with all these different shoe manufacturers. Think about the warehouses. If you remember Webvan and .com era failures, this is what they would do. They would build out this massive infrastructure first, then go to market. And Zappos began much more humbly with a classic minimum viable product. They went to a local shoe store, if I remember right, here in Palo Alto. They said, listen, we're going to take a digital camera into the store. We'll photograph the shoes you have on sale. We'll put them online. And if anybody buys them, if you'll permit this, we'll come back to your store. We will buy the shoes and we will personally ship them to the customers who bought. So no inventory, no deals, no, just a digital camera and a very simple web page. And if customers had no interest at that time in buying shoes online, they would have found out really soon and would have had a chance to pivot. But the key of the minimum viable product is it's a learning exercise. It's not just they wanted to build a small business, so just one little shoe store. They were trying to learn what are the fundamental things that have to be true in order for this thing to be big. And you know, when Zappos sold for $1 billion, I'm sure they were quite glad that they had done the MVP.
We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Eric Ries, who is an entrepreneur, and he is with the Harvard Business School. He's also written a book called The Lean Startup, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses. I'm curious about some of the subtitle here. Continuous innovation means, I presume, just that. You're always looking, perhaps, instead of plans and forecasts and bringing the budget on time, at what the customer wants. But I mean by radically successful businesses.
Well, what we focus on here in Silicon Valley, and if you talk to people in traditional businesses, what they're always looking for is not just a small business, a clone of something that's been done before. And no disrespect to the small business owners who, run a small bookstore or dry cleaner. I mean, those businesses are important. But what we're focused on are businesses that can achieve hypergrowth because we want to have a disproportionate impact. And that's true in the case of something like a Zappos or Groupon, where we're looking to really get big. But also, if you look at the industrial landscape and you think about the old big, powerful company of the 20th century, like a General Motors. It used to be that once you went public with an idea like General Motors to have a diversified product portfolio of cars for every price, you could have market dominance on the strength of basically that one good idea for decades. Think about how long General Motors was number one. But if you look at today's companies, and in fact, the companies that have survived from the 20th century, the world is changing much too fast to rely on that kind of market leadership for any given amount of time. In fact, average lifespan of the Fortune 500 has been steadily decreasing now for decades. So our modern companies are facing waves of disruption and chaos that they never had to deal with before. And they need these tools also in order to figure out how do we continuously reinvent ourselves so that the thousands of competitors who are constantly being formed are coming after us. So here in Silicon Valley, we love that disruption and chaos. That's the opportunity we seek. Our colleagues in established business, it's a source of great heartburn. And I was recently with a Fortune 100 CEO, quite powerful person, who has started asking his internal teams when they pitch him their 5-year plans. He said, "Is this the same way an entrepreneur right now in China who is pursuing this opportunity, would they be making a plan like that?" And of course, it's a rhetorical question because the answer is always no. But starting to think about how do we think like entrepreneurs? How do we build the support systems to allow entrepreneurs to operate even in our established companies is a really important part of this.
Isn't this also an important part having to do with branding and making sure that you have a brand that's recognizable?
It is. But it's really interesting. A well-known brand can be a liability. Because if you're taking the brand, I work a lot with a company like Intuit, who has a real brand for quality and products that consumers really like. For them to experiment in a minimum viable product under the Intuit brand, it's very dangerous. They're worried that maybe customers will try a product, not like it. The challenge of entrepreneurship is you often get it wrong at first. That means customers could be unhappy. That's not the traditional thing. But I think that people have to get over that, basically, that we have to take the brand and either experiment under a different brand or just say, you know what, we're going to let customers know that this is an experiment, that we're trying something new. If they don't like it, we'll always make it right. We'll always apologize. The great thing about getting it wrong is you don't have very many customers to apologize to because it's not like a lot of people used it. It's that the whole point was that you didn't get very many.
Well, you're implying, a constant self-criticism and a constant looking for better ways and more efficiency and using better resources and all that.
Continuous improvement is an old
idea. But you also set out kind of a semaphore warning against vanity metrics and too much reliance on vanity metrics.
Oh, yeah. When I go to startup board meetings, there's always a chart that's up and to the right. Now, it may not be the same chart that was from last board meeting, but you can always use your analytics, modern analytics tools, big data. There's a lot of tools that will always help you find something that's going well. And we always say if your goal is to just ship something and see what happens, you are guaranteed to succeed at seeing what happens. Because something will definitely happen, and then you can claim that to be a success. We call those vanity metrics because those are the numbers that companies love to put in their press release to make their competitors feel bad about themselves. Our system has 100 million messages have been sent on it. And if you give that any thought at all, you realize the reason they like to put those numbers in a press release is they reveal nothing about the business. It could be 100 million people each sent one message and then left. Or it could be one person who likes our product awfully, a little bit too much.
Or it could be just an inflated number, which it often is.
Or it could be completely made up. Yeah. There's no way to know. Now, a question about why our journalists print numbers that they know don't reveal anything about the business is a deeper question maybe for another day. But they're using the press and the publicity engine to try to make their company look good. We call it success theater, putting on a show about how great the company is. And that's fine to make your competitors feel bad. I mean, I have done that too myself. I understand. But every ounce of energy that goes into success theater is actually an ounce of energy that could have gone into making customers' lives better and didn't. So what we're trying to do in the Lean Startup Movement is say, at least in private, at least when we're being real with each other, with our investors, with our board members, with ourselves, with our employees, let's look at real metrics that actually have predictive power that help us understand not what has happened before, but what is likely to happen in the future. And when we take that more rigorous approach, we often discover that companies are working really hard making the product, quote unquote, better. And they're actually wasting their time entirely. The customers don't perceive the product as better at all.
How do you distinguish or quantify what real metrics are?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of math involved. And in fact, a lot of the book, as you know, is really about accounting. And when people want to hear about the latest cool thing in entrepreneurship, believe me, they did not come expecting accounting. But my belief is that the accounting systems we use really are fundamental to how we hold people accountable. And that's a critical part of entrepreneurship. So the short version is we want to look at numbers that are denominated like in real people and in per customer numbers. So instead of saying how many millions of messages were sent, we want to say, well, how many messages were sent on average per person? And what's really interesting is when you start to take that view, you can sometimes see things that the vanity metrics obscure. You mentioned at the top the story of Twitter. when they made the pivot from Odeo, the podcasting company, into Twitter, there's a story I've heard from several people, so I believe it, that they had only a couple of hundred users in Twitter. So the vanity metrics were really low. And they were so embarrassed, they went to some of their investors and offered them their money back. And several of Silicon Valley's smartest, you know, richest, most powerful investors said, yes, what a great deal. Thank you so much. I made a billion-dollar mistake. But that's because the vanity metrics said nothing was going on. If you looked under the hood and say, well, how many messages are being sent per customer? They had customers who, in those days, everyone had to pay per text message, and Twitter was all text messages. They had customers racking up hundreds of dollars in cell phone bills and were really angry at Twitter because it was costing them so much money, but they couldn't stop because the product was so addictive. So it's just a different view of looking at the same data that can give us a much better insight as to not just what's happened, but what's going to happen.
Our guest this hour, if you just joined us, is Eric Ries. He's entrepreneur in residence at the Harvard Business School and author of The Lean Startup, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses, and founder of the Lean Startup Conference, which, by the way, will be held December 3rd to the 4th at the Intercontinental San Francisco Hotel. I'm going to give those of you listening an opportunity to join in this conversation. We'd certainly like to hear from you if you have some thoughts about startups, particularly if you have some experience with startups or have had experience. Being involved in startups, what you think works or what doesn't work, and certainly if you have interest in starting up a startup, there may be a better way to, or more elegant way of saying that. We welcome your phone calls and your involvement in the program. And in fact, you can call us now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement, so feel free to call us. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments you have there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And we certainly like to hear from some of you who think you might have some gleaning as to what works best in the world of startups from your own experience, or for that matter, what doesn't work or what hasn't worked. Let's talk about your track record for a minute, Eric.
You've worked
at a lot of – you've had successful startups. You've had startups that haven't been successful. You even left Yale as an undergraduate to get involved in a startup.
Yes, my poor parents.
And now you're doing a lot of work with big companies, which is really sort of interesting, because a lot of these principles of lean methodology apply, as you see it, to the larger corporate world and the big – like Intuit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, it's kind of it's really a full circle thing from a kind of history of management point of view, because so many of these ideas were pioneered in manufacturing. And now many of my clients are big manufacturing companies who, as a matter of operational efficiency, are outstanding. When they need to build a big gas turbine engine, they're really good at it. But figuring out what turbine engine to build in the first place, which market to enter when they're doing stuff that's new, that's where the challenges come in. So, you know, you mentioned the conference we're having starting on the 3rd. You know, we had these different strands of the community that have come together to be in the conference. We have the Silicon Valley strand, you know, represented by like a Marc Andreessen, one of our keynote speakers. But we also have folks from GE and from Intuit. Beth Comstock, the chief marketing officer of GE, will be there to talk about this very thing, about how do we bring these entrepreneurial ideas into established companies. And we'll also have Todd Park, the chief technology officer of the United States, talking about what does Lean Startup mean in the context of a government bureaucracy. And that's a really wild thing. So, you know,
you've been working with the federal government as well.
Yeah, that's
right. But you also work with Dropbox and GE, and I mean, there's
it's been a crazy ride.
It's a big list. Yeah.
Believe me, I grew up as an engineer. I go, oh, thank you very much. It's quite the vanity metric, I know. You know, I grew up programming computers in my parents' basement. So, you know, you got to picture me not as an extroverted speaker. I was really on computer. I thought I would be programming computers my whole life. And this has been really unusual detour for me into something really that's very different, very public.
It's not all that usual for, I mean, you know, the word geek is overused, but, you know, a lot of geeks become entrepreneurs. I mean, and it seems like a kind of natural metamorphosis in many instances. But those who do want to be entrepreneurs and who do want to have startup, geek or not geek, whatever, you know, they face the same kind of challenges.
That's right.
And you point out, I think, quite justifiably, that a lot of times venture capital can be a much slower and more onerous process, and in fact, painful process than most people realize.
From the outside, it looks very glamorous, like many things. But when you get into the nitty-gritty of it, it's quite hard. And I've actually grown incredibly sympathetic towards the people that have to finance and hold entrepreneurs accountable. You know, it's when entrepreneurs get together in private, and this is true in corporate settings too, we heap scorn on the vulture capitalists and the CFOs who are constantly canceling promising projects, their financial accounting perspective. But, you know, from their point of view, what happens is you get this business plan and this pitch from an entrepreneur, and it sounds great. And the pitch is always, listen, if you give me all this money, I promise you a year from now, we're going to be on the cover of magazines and have all these results. You write the check, and then time passes, time lapse, year later, and all of a sudden, you come back, and what do we know for sure? Well, I guarantee you for sure the money's been spent right on time. The money's gone. I guarantee everybody involved was very busy, but most of the time, there's no results. From the point of view of the vanity metrics, the traditional accounting metrics, there's not millions of customers, but hundreds. And if you've ever gone into a venture capitalist office, as I have, and had a pitch with the hockey stick-shaped graph, you know, showing how much progress you've made, and the venture capitalist says, oh, this is exciting. What are the units on this graph? Is this in thousands? And if you ever have to say, no, sir, it's in ones, as I have, it's – let me put it this way. I don't recommend that as an approach. But that's what they're forced to do. They look at these plans that, you know, things fall way short of the plan, and now it's like, well, who's done a good job? And a team that, in fact, is on the brink of success, like an Odeo pivoting into Twitter, and a team that was doing nothing and just squandered your money and was goofing off, throwing parties, they would both have pathetically small numbers of customers.
Well, there was a lot of that during the boom, how well we remember.
Yeah, exactly right.
And it brings up another question in my mind, and that is the uncertainty that you talk about with startups has a lot to do with the economy. I mean, it's contingent in many ways on boom and bust, and that's really what the economy is all about.
It is. And a lot of the great companies, if you look historically, started during the bust time, not the boom. And part of the reason is just that forces you to be more disciplined in your approach. And, you know, it's human nature. I mean, logically, you should be just as disciplined during the boom as during the bust. But it's very hard when the money is flowing easily and companies are being funded at outrageous valuations. It's all too easy to fall into the trap of success theater and throwing the parties and buying the Super Bowl ads and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I always try to remind entrepreneurs that winter is coming. You know, entrepreneurship is very cool right now, and people are excited, and there's movies, the social network, all these, and it's very glamorous. But anyone who's actually been an entrepreneur will tell you, entrepreneurship is not cool. It is not like it is in the movies. It is grueling and humiliating and embarrassing and difficult. And one of the great things about the bust that inevitably come after these periods of exuberance is it kind of flushes out people who have come into the ecosystem for the wrong reasons. So, you know, I look forward to that.
Well, you've become kind of a missionary. I mean, you're...
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, you have sort of the true believer as far as the lean methodology is concerned and lean manufacturing. And that's your message. And we'll get some responses, no doubt, from listeners about that. Again, we'd like to hear from you if you have thoughts about startups, if you've been involved in any. Again, particularly interested in hearing from some of you as to what worked and what didn't work, but also a good opportunity for some of you who have been thinking about a startup, whether in your basement or your garage or in your attic or in your roof or whatever, maybe just sitting in some kind of coffee shop. A lot of dreaming going on, particularly in Silicon Valley.
Amen.
Let us know what your questions are and your concerns are. A number of ways of joining us, again, toll-free. Our number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and a click onto this segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle, again, is @KQED Forum. Eric Ries, The Lean Startup is his book, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses. He's also founder of the Lean Startup Conference. Your blog is still going, isn't it?
It is. Startup Lessons Learned.
Startup blog. More on startups when we return. More from you, our listeners, when we return. In fact, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Eric Ries is our guest this hour, author of The Lean Startup, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses. And when Odeo first started as a podcasting company, as we said, it had so few customers it offered to give its investors their money back, but it looked at what its customers wanted, changed its model, and became the company we know as Twitter. And we mentioned a number of other stories. One of them was the story about Pez dispensers and eBay. And Stacy writes on our Facebook page, FYI, the Pez dispenser eBay story is a myth that was started by a PR firm to promote eBay. Eric Ries's book obviously wasn't fact-checked, but regardless, Forum is sharing the story as if true. You may want to mention that the Pez story was just marketing. And, well, we looked it up on CNN, a money story. It says, startup lies companies tell you. Iconic brands like to have romantic stories of how they got started. Here's the truth behind some creation myths. One of eBay's first employees, Song, grew frustrated trying to get the attention of dot-com-weary reporters. She hit on the notion of telling them that founder Pierre Onodeyar had started the site to help his fiance find more Pez dispensers she collected. There it is. I mean,
I appreciate
you had
that.
It in your book. I bought into it too, and mea culpa. But it also, I mean, we could do a whole hour on this, just on the
well, the mythology that you know,
the
it's
mythology,
actually,
but also fact checking. You know, I've had. There was a fact that didn't get checked by me or my publisher in one of my books, and it went out, and it still kind of sits in – it's just a date of a poem. You know, nobody cares about it. And people probably don't even care about Pez dispensers, but you want to be absolutely accurate.
Oh, yeah. It was actually a real challenge in writing the book because I tried as much as possible to avoid these public case studies because it's very hard to know what's true and what's not. And I tried to write about stories where I knew the entrepreneur. I actually seen what had happened. And the challenge is that companies really want to have an official mythological founding story that sounds really good for PR purposes. And so like in the case of eBay, you know, the myth is that, you know, he was just sitting around one day and built this thing for his girlfriend. The truth is that the early days, eBay was in fact used for collectibles to trade Pez dispensers and Beanie Babies and a lot of other stuff like that. But they were intending to build an online auction platform. I mean, they had the vision. It's just – no matter how big the vision is, even in the case of, you know, of eBay and Facebook, all these big vision companies, you have to start somewhere. And often the place you have to start is not very glamorous and therefore doesn't make a very good story. And so when it comes time for the publicist to get involved, it's really, you know, it makes sense from a publicity point of view to
create these stories out of whole cloth.
Do this total mythology. But when entrepreneurs use those stories to guide their actions is when they get in trouble.
Well, let's guide our action toward our callers. And we begin, Brian, with you. Good morning.
Hey there, Eric. I am run a foundation that essentially is trying to do school startup for new innovative school models here in the Bay Area. And we're big believers in the lean methodology. And yet what's interesting is starting a school is essentially the opposite of a lean startup. You're spending a couple years in planning and upwards of $1 million, and you're essentially trying a new model that you may or may not know whether it works. So we're big proponents of rapid prototyping and trying to do thoughtful experiments before launch. But I'd be curious to hear your take about specifically new startup spaces in the education world or just nonprofits in general where it's not as easy to enter and exit and that there's real consequences for failure.
Yeah, I really appreciate the question and I honor what you're working on. It is difficult, and that's true. You know, like I said, even when we're doing energy generation and aircraft engines and big industrial equipment, we have the same problem that there's, you know, years of development required and substantial hard costs, and where the cost of failure can be quite high. Now, but even in those cases, as you said, there are prototypes that we can build to help us figure out what's going on in parallel. So even if it's true that we have to spend years developing, you know, a physical plant or something like that. In parallel, while we're doing that product development, we can still be double checking. It's just a double check that our fundamental assumptions are true. So, for example, in any kind of nonprofit, we need to figure out how will we attract, you know, clients, educators, students, and parents to get involved with our school. What's really the value proposition that they will resonate with? And then, often in a nonprofit setting, we also have to figure out. Is there a version of that same value proposition that donors would be interested in funding? And so if you think of it like a Venn diagram, we're trying to figure out what is a set of things that is attractive to one set of customers and how do we find the overlap with that second set of customers so we find something that is in fact in the middle of the Venn diagram or are we just looking at headlights that are completely separate? And that's the same issue, you know, you heard in the previous hour about Facebook where figuring out what the end user wants and then how do you track them at the same time attracting advertisers to want to spend money to advertise to those same people. It's always this kind of multi-customer segment problem. We're trying to kind of optimize for all of them together. And so even in those cases, there are minimum viable products we can build to kind of test demand, test how people respond to a value proposition even long before the actual physical school is built.
Let me thank Brian for the call, and I want to go to more of your calls, but getting a lot of tweets. One of them from Darius writes, what are some differences in lean startup methods between startups pre- and post-funding?
Yeah, you know, it really shouldn't be any different. Ideally, we would operate the same whether we have $10 in the bank or $10 million in the bank. What we want to do is always be asking ourselves which activities that we do create value, help us learn scientifically what customers want if we're on the path to a sustainable business. And that should be true at the bootstrap stage as well as in the venture stage. Now, as we get bigger, not because we raise money, but because we have real success with customers, as soon as we have any customers at all, now we have a new problem. How do we figure out, should we keep investing and pleasing our current customers, or should we seek out new customers and new sources of growth? And if that sounds like the same problems that big companies have, congratulations.
It is.
I talk to entrepreneurs all the time who hate big companies. They think they're bureaucratic, and they're always talking. And I said, if you hate big companies so much, why are you trying to create a new one? Our goal is to create a new generation of companies that we're seeking to have those problems. And the reason it was so important to me that Lean Startup be based in the thinking of lean manufacturing, even though with some tweaks, of course, is that we want to lay the groundwork from day one that the kind of company we're building can be the kind of learning organization that's something that can do continuous improvement, continuous innovation, hopefully not just for a few years, but for many decades, as Toyota has done.
Of course, it becomes more challenging as you get bigger and go from the micro to the macro. But let's go to another caller. And Maggie, that's you. Welcome. You're on Forum.
Hi. My question is similar to the tweet you received previously. I find what startups do when they fundraise is frequently a very different process from what they're doing inside the organization. A lot of people who are telling you what to do when you fundraise tell you to hire people that you perhaps don't need so you can put them on the team slide, or spend a lot of time on design when maybe that's not the best use of your time. And, the most important thing early on is to get money so you can keep your startup alive. And I wondered what you think the answer to that question is.
Well, the best way to raise money is to have a product that customers love so that you have what they call traction, actual evidence that an overwhelming number of customers want your product. We always joke, you're making so much money, you need to raise money in order to buy more cash registers to cash all the checks that are piling into your office. That's the best kind of fundraising pitch. All this other fundraising advice about how to make a good pitch falls into the category of success theater. It's in the absence of traction. How do we raise money anyway? And there are a lot of situations where that's what's required. But I'll just give you one story from my experience where you can kind of – it's a little bit of venture capital jujitsu. We had a product in one of my previous startups. We raised $8 million with a product that basically half the time you would use it would crash your computer. It was quite bad. It was very early minimum viable product. It was a very complicated product, technically challenging. We were not done building it. But we had early promising results. I mentioned, it denominated in ones, not thousands. But still customers liked our product. We had some traction. And we would come in and we would demo it live for the venture capitalist on their computer. And we were always rolling the dice. Sometimes it would work, but oftentimes it would crash the computer. And the venture capitalist would say, it really shouldn't crash. Or they would give us advice. This design is not very good. And we would write down all their suggestions. And then we would say, so do you think if we followed your advice, very sage advice, thank you so much, the company would be worth more? And they would say, oh, yes, I'm probably 10 times or 100 times more valuable if the thing didn't crash. We say, oh, that's so brilliant. Thank you so much. And we say, well, look at the results we've had now with a product that does crash. You've already told us that we should be at least 100 times more valuable once we fix that problem. And with your money, we'll be able to fix those problems. And now they've actually just given us the argument why we should have a higher valuation.
Let me thank the caller. Actually, Terrence writes, on the issue of metrics, how does Eric quantify success for these startups? He mentioned Zappos and Groupon as heralding this wave of lean startups. However, both these companies are suspect when it comes to earnings potentials. Isn't earnings potential the metric most frequently relied upon to determine business success?
That's absolutely right. And like I said, once companies achieve substantial scale, a different set of challenges and techniques apply, some of which are relevant to lean startup and others are strictly in the realm of traditional business strategy. The problem with earnings is it's extremely hard to evaluate who has the earnings and growth potential in advance. One Silicon Valley big company just recently announced that they're no longer going to pursue any new product initiatives unless they have the potential to make at least $100 million. And I thought that was totally fascinating because if they have the ability through analysis to figure out in advance which products are going to be worth at least $100 million, they probably wouldn't be in a position where they had to make that announcement in the first place. The problem is that analysis only takes us so far. Startups are in the realm of the leap of faith where we're trying to figure out if we have the potential to have substantial earnings growth. And the only way to find that out is to have, by definition, a different set of metrics that we can look at before it's clear what we'll look like in traditional accounting sense.
Got a couple of emails before we go to more calls. Here's Bob who writes, Lean startups coincidentally appeared with a reduction in venture capital support to startups in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. They are a valid response to not having enough money. Are they an effective response? Not so far. In Sweden, where I have been observing startups for the past 5 years, the lean startups tend to be copycats and also focused on the smallest possible viable products and services, not products and services with great appeal to buyers. The pivot is a result of poor planning and or the wrong data in most cases, but now it's acceptable. Most pivoting firms, like those that did more comprehensive planning when funding was more prolific, still fail by a large percentage. Pivoting is just replanning, but without enough resources. And he adds, I'm a three-time startup CEO and a former board member of the Silicon Valley Association of Startup Entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I bow to his great wisdom. This is a difficult thing to assess and is by no means a panacea. I think that people sometimes confuse lean with cheap. So people get very focused on the fundraising part of this, on how much money companies have or don't have. And in fact, during the downturn in 08-09, I was just starting to talk about lean startup, and it was very fortuitous in Silicon Valley. I was known as the lean startup guy right when every venture-backed company was being told to cut their costs. So they would call me thinking I would give them tips on how to get cheaper office furniture or cheaper chairs. And what I tried to explain to them is that there's a fundamental cycle time that matters for startups. We call it build, measure, learn, how fast you're learning from the things that you do from your customers. And if you cut costs that slow down that build, measure, learn feedback loop, if you diminish your engineering capability, if you eradicate your ability to collect data, then that's just helping you go out of business more slowly. But that's nothing to be proud of. Instead, we want to figure out which costs are a form of waste. The early, the premature PR, the unnecessary marketing folks, the fancy office that don't actually help us learn faster. Let's cut those costs. But then if you're going to cut those costs in a downturn, why not just cut those costs all the time? Why not just develop a real discipline that figures out what are the dollars that we spend that actually help us build a sustainable business and eliminate everything else?
There's supposed to be a big announcement by NASA, and NASA, was heralding the fact that they're lean now, but not only leaner, but more efficient and better operated and more innovative. Alex writes, could you address limitations to lean startup? I can't see this working with something like starting up, say, a distillery where you have costs like specialized equipment, bonded warehouses, payment of taxes, and so on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the general idea here, if you think about, like any good consultant, you got to have a 2x2 matrix in your mind. And on one axis, you have what's the level of market uncertainty that you face in a given industry. So if we're building something that's like version 10 of a product we've built before, we know exactly what the customer wants. It's pretty low. Building a radical new, social network for pets or something, we don't know if customers want that. It's quite speculative, so very high. And on the other axis, you have to ask, what's the underlying fundamental cycle time to the business in question? I was just working with an appliance company that comes up with a new model only once every 5 to 8 years. Automobiles are refreshed once a year. On the fast side, we have consumer internet companies like my last company, InView, where we ship the product to customers on average about 50 times per day, which sounds crazy, but it can be done. So that's a very fast cycle time. So in that upper right-hand quadrant where we have really high market uncertainty and very fast cycle time potential, that's the sweet spot for a lean startup. And when we're low in both dimensions, it's not as applicable. But there's a caveat, which is if you think about, all right, on each axis in your industry, what direction is the world moving in? Do you feel like the world is getting more certain or more uncertain? Do you feel like things are going faster or slower? I have yet to meet a single person who says, boy, in my industry, everything's becoming much more stable and everything's slowing down. It's really great. The same underlying forces of the semiconductor revolution, software, the technology and management principles that we're talking about are driving cycle time down and increasing uncertainty in industry after industry after industry. So I usually tell people, this is coming soon to an industry near you, whether you like it or not. And it's fine with me if you think it doesn't apply now, but call me later.
Eric Ries with us in studio. His book is The Lean Startup, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses. And we go to more of your calls, and we go to Richard next. Richard, join us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning, Eric. Thank you. Definitely a big fan of your writing, and
thank
I appreciate you.
You
all having the show today. So I'm actually, I'd say, a lean startup proprietor. I've been at this since 1995 and have worked for many, many companies that I think would fit your classification of a lean startup. I'm also 46 years old now with two children and a family, and I feel like there's this real, incredibly tangible challenge for me as a lean startup participant trying to find that life-work balance, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being a fan, and thanks for calling in. I don't want to pretend like this is not a challenge. I even find it challenging. I'm still a relatively young person, and I don't have kids. But
well, let me just say, I'm sorry to put in here, but a number of years ago, I was asked to lead a conference of CEOs, many of them from the Silicon Valley, and it turned out the biggest concern they had, to a man and few women, not enough
unfortunately,
women,
yeah.
Was how do you do that balance, you know, between mm-hmm. your free time and the life with your family or you know, friends or whatever, and the work that is so demanding. I mean, startups can be almost really literally dawn to dusk every day.
You know, it's interesting. It's all-consuming. And I certainly remember in the early days of some of the startups where people would always ask me, when are you working? How much do you work? And I would say, you don't understand. I'm never, ever not working. I'm in the shower. I'm thinking about this startup all the time. But the other thing I realized was because it really tapped into a deeply held passion that I had, the work was effortless. I mean, I was always working, even when I was, it was actually important to take time away from the office and like the kind of 9-to-5 type work because I had to let my unconscious work on it because I was so passionate about it. Even when I was with my family, even when I was doing something completely unrelated, I was actually still making progress. And I realized that a lot of our culture of workaholism and being in the office and FaceTime and all-nighters, that actually is a legacy of a kind of work that's actually kind of soul crushing, if we're being honest.
It's a Puritan work ethic, really.
Yeah, it doesn't actually lead to a lot of progress. And the entrepreneurs I know that are really the most passionate about their businesses, they're able to have work-life balance because they realize that, this is a really long-haul marathon. If this is going to work. This is going to require finding that balance and building a culture of balance from the very beginning. Otherwise, we're going to burn ourselves out. And sure, you might make it to the first milestone faster, but over the long haul, you're really in trouble.
Let me thank the caller, and let me go to more of your calls. We go to Palo Alto. Murali, good morning.
Hi. Hello. I'm in run an organization called Agile Entrepreneur.
Yes, sir. Are you talking on a walkie-talkie? I'm not clear that you're coming through here.
I'm sorry. It's an iPhone. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, no, that's better. Thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to say I am the founder and organizer of a group called Agile Entrepreneurs in Palo Alto. And we are a network who work for startups.
No, I'm sorry. We're going to have to get a better connection. You're just not coming through. Let me go to another caller here. And that's Greg in Sunnyvale. Hi, Greg.
Hi there. Great show today, both hours. Terrific show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've got a story about using some of these lean principles. I founded a startup called Genomera, and we began this startup right when some of these principles that Eric's book is about were coming to the fore. We started thinking we were going to do genetic interpretation for people, and we began interviewing potential users and customers doing customer development and found that it was a crowded, small market. But through those interviews, rather than building our product first, we found out about a bigger problem to solve, which was helping people discover the interpretation that we thought we were going to deliver them. As we started to serve that need, we found out that actually that was a microcosm of a much bigger problem, which was helping people bring efficiency and scale to how they do health studies in general. And that's the market we're now serving. And we went from serving a sub-$1 billion market to a $40 billion market by efficiently doing this learning, building, refining loop that Eric's talking about.
Yeah. Eric, want to comment?
Yeah, thanks for that story. And it's what's cool to me is to see these techniques branch out beyond the kinds of companies I was involved in personally as an engineer into whole different industries and people working in bioscience, in industry, in clean tech. It's really been it's just very inspiring to see people really take these ideas and run with them. And
lean startup ideas, I'm getting emails here, apply to government, apply to
all
kinds of businesses, apply to innovation in a general sense. And let's apply another caller here. Tree is calling us. Good morning, Tree.
Hi there.
Yeah, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Eric. This is Tree and Munchery. You're one of our customers.
you have a great product.
Yeah, thank you. It's still hard. We're nowhere successful in the grand scheme of things, but we're making great traction. But I do want to echo on the other caller who mentioned, how to make it as a dad or a mom or you know, as a parent in general. And yeah, I mean, my my comment there would be, you know, you gotta get your full support from your spouse. I mean, if you don't have that full support from your spouse, like I did, or when my co-founder Conrad did, there is no way it's gonna go. I mean, at least I have no way of seeing how that would work if my spouse were not endorsing the company that we start and fully believe in it like I do. So I think that's key. And then the other aspect of it is, you know, can you have the financial foundation to potentially have no income for a year or two? You know, if you can withstand that and prepare for that, I think you at least give yourself a fair chance of make it or break it. Otherwise, there are real responsibilities that we all have as parents. So yeah, I just want to echo on that and share my thought on that.
I'm glad you did. And yeah, thank you for the call.
Thank you for that. Munchery is a great product. If anyone in San Francisco needs dinner tonight, get it on your phone. It's actually very cool.
Let me read some tweets here. Nancy says, how does a startup that has to operate in secrecy stealth get out of the building and validate its assumptions?
This is excellent. It's actually a very easy answer, which is that don't be secret. Don't be in stealth. Now, no one ever believes me when I say this. I've talked to so many entrepreneurs who think their idea is so brilliant, so innovative, so original that as soon as they tell even one person about it, it will be instantly copied by every big company and they'll be doomed. And so for you, was it Nancy? I have a homework assignment for you that will cure you of this fear for the rest of your life. And that is, take one of your ideas. It doesn't have to be your best idea, but I know you have a list. Pick like number 3 or number 5 off that list and try to get someone to steal it. This is your exercise. Go find the relevant product manager at the right big company who should be doing that right now and try to get them to steal your idea. Write them a memo, send them a business plan, go meet with, do whatever it takes, get them to steal your idea. And I guarantee after a few hours of trying that, you will never be worried about having your idea stolen again. And then you'll be free to get out of the building, as Steve Blank likes to say.
Let me go to a couple more tweets here. Listener tweets, can you tell us of a large company that successfully implemented Lean Startup but without executive support?
No. This is something that requires executive support, and I'll explain why. Scott Cook, who's the founder of Intuit, also, by the way, speaking at the conference, you know, he's a role model for so many of us as entrepreneurs because he built a Fortune 1000 company in a really admirable way. It makes great products. But now his challenge, the company is 8,000 people, is to turn his employees into entrepreneurs. So not just to do what he did as an individual, but now make that an industrial process that can be replicated across so many of his employees. And what he says is, in traditional management culture, we train managers to play Caesar, which is someone brings you an idea and you give it the thumbs up or the thumbs down, should it live or die. And you just analyze your way to a good idea. But he says that's not really the right model for leadership in the 21st century. Leadership in the 21st century requires giving employees platforms for experimentation to discover for themselves which ideas are good or bad. And then they bring back the data about what actually works, not proposals about what might work. So that requires buy-in, support, leadership from the very top. And all the companies I've worked with that have been successful in these kind of transformations have had executive sponsorship at the very top levels of the company. And in fact, I often get brought in. I'm a terrible consultant, by the way. People who are thinking about hiring me as a consultant, people bring me in to make their company more efficient, more lean. And of course, what they want me to tell them is to put up posters that say everybody be more innovative and fire the non-innovative people. And of course, I always say, listen, senior management, if you want to know the problem, hold up a mirror and now you're looking at it. This requires changes in the behavior from the very, very top of the company. And of course, it doesn't make me the most popular consultant, but I do believe that that's true.
Another tweet from a listener named Scott. What systems do you use to capture and organize information you generate in customer interviews and when testing a product?
The answer is as simple as possible. And in fact, this is an old Lean manufacturing technique. They were notorious for taking complicated multi-million-dollar software ERP systems and replacing them with a whiteboard. And that's the same thing that we do in Lean Startup. We want to take our experiments, write them down. So we write down what we think is going to happen. And then make sure that we actually go back and test that it did happen. But the limiting factor in a startup is not how fast we can build or how fast we can measure. It's actually how fast we can learn. Learning is a slow and difficult process. Human beings are the bottleneck. So we can't be doing that many things because we can't be learning from that many things. So, it's a technique called Kanban, again, from Lean Manufacturing, which is about having a simple board where we write down, here are the different things that we have in progress right now, limiting the number of things we're allowed to do at any one time, and making sure that we validate each thing before we do the next. And you can see diagrams and stuff like that in my book and online. But it really... in some ways, it's too simple. People want something complicated. They want a robot to do the work for them. But really, this is a philosophical system that requires taking a scientific mindset, and therefore the change is in the mind much more than it's in the tools.
Eric Ries, author of The Lean Startup, with us in studio. Boy, here's a question that opens up many cans of worms and maybe really out of your line of fire, your bailiwick. Listener writes, U.S. immigration system actively discourages and prevents immigrants, especially from China and India, because of the quota system from starting companies. What can we do about that? For example, I came to the States from MIT to go to MIT, but now as a result of the immigration policy, all my ambitious friends have to leave the States and start companies in their home countries.
I'm really glad we got this question, and this is an outrage. I mean, really, I find this so disturbing. I've been a big proponent of a very straightforward legislative solution to this problem called the startup visa, and it's very simple. Right now, there is no category in the law for entrepreneurship visa. So if you are working for a big company in an H-1B visa, that's fine. If you are yourself an investor and bring millions of dollars to this company, to this country, you can get a visa. But there's no visa for entrepreneurs. And if you ask yourself, someone who becomes an entrepreneur in the United States, what were they doing 5 minutes beforehand? The answer is they were a student, like Larry and Sergey, a PhD student at Stanford, or they were here on an H-1B visa working in a big company. And so in both those cases, we have brought them to this country, educated them, invested resources in them, and at the very moment they want to pay us back by becoming actual job creators, not the bogus job creators of our public policy debates, but actually build a company, that's the very moment we say, get out of our country, go back home. It's outrageous. And it's really foolish. It's a very short-sighted policy that is costing us jobs and economic leadership.
And I'm glad we brought this up.
Oh, it's just outrageous.
Got some passion from you to end this program with. Thank you for being with us.
It's my honor. Thank you so much.
Glad to have you. Eric Ries's new book, The Lean Startup, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses, and founder of the Lean Startup Conference, which will take place December 3rd, 4th at the Intercontinental San Francisco Hotel. You can find it online, I presume.
Oh, yes, leanstartup.co.
And we thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this conversation by going online, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also let us know what you think by going to our Facebook page or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.